Thank you. Who else but Joan Sutherland, sharing from Semiramide, an aria scene that our guest is going to describe for us and also explain why, for him, who else but Joan Sutherland to launch our program. I'm Andrew Pattner. Welcome to another edition of Critical Thinking. This is the first of a two-part series that we've wanted to do for some time, and busy people all around, but we have pinned down one of the busiest and one of the most committed and interesting figures in the Chicago music and arts scene. Anthony Freud is general director of Lyric Opera of Chicago. He's held that or similar positions at Houston Grand Opera and the Welsh National Opera and been involved with music, particularly vocal music, but he has a great love, as you'll hear, as well for the piano, orchestra, etc., throughout his life. A native of London, he will take over with me in talking with us and with you about music that has mattered to him and matters still to him, and we'll also talk about what it is that he does in the world of opera and here in Chicago at the Lyric. Anthony Freud, welcome.
Thank you, Andrew. Great to be here.
Tell us about selection number one.
All my cares have vanished from my heart. All fear has faded. A beautiful, enchanted gleam of hope shines for me at last. That's what Semiramide sings from Rossini's opera. It's a glorious aria and a staggering piece of singing. Dame Joan Sutherland is, for me, why I fell head over heels in love with opera, and specifically that aria. As a child growing up in London, I got hooked on classical music, on theatre, on ballet from a very early age. And I grew up in Wimbledon in southwest London, and I used to go regularly to buy records, and they were records, LPs in those days, from Harrods record sale. Ah. Harrods had a great record sale. Mm-hmm. And I used to get up early and arrive in Harrods on the first day of the sale and got the best bargains. And one day I arrived in Harrods, and in the background, that aria was playing. Mm. And I was...
How old were you? Do you recall?
I must have been 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And I was a very shy, unassuming child. And I was basically stopped in my tracks by that singing. Mm. I was gobsmacked by it. Mm-hmm. And I plucked up all my courage and went to the shop assistant and asked, "What's that?" And in a very supercilious voice, he told me it was Semiramide, which I now know he mispronounced, sung by Joan Sutherland. And I suppose that was the first time that I realized that the human voice in full flight could truly change my life. Mm-hmm. And Sutherland was my first favorite singer, and starting to go to Covent Garden, as I did incessantly from the early 70s onwards, I was lucky enough to hear her in many roles many times. And even luckier later in life, when I was general director of Welsh National Opera, and as a result of that, was chairman of the jury of the BBC Cardiff Singer of the World competition for 12 years, Joan was fairly regularly a member of the jury. And so I had the enormous thrill of both getting to know her a little bit and also sitting next to her for many concerts and having the benefit of her own thoughts and opinions whispered to me about some of the singers that we were hearing. She was a wonderful woman, full of self-deprecating humor. And you can imagine, I think, the thrill that I felt sitting in the concert hall, St. David's Hall in Cardiff, as a general director of Welsh National Opera, having been stopped in my tracks many years earlier by the sound of her voice.
She was also a woman with strong opinions about, she could be self-deprecating, but she could think highly or not so highly of other singers. Did you find, and we won't ask for any secrets to be revealed, but did you find that you would agree with her opinions, or that you sometimes agreed and sometimes disagreed when you were looking at this new talent, somewhat raw perhaps at that point?
She had very strong opinions, yeah, and expressed them extremely bluntly, not only in private, but also to the singers themselves.
Yes, I saw that.
I often agreed with her. Mm-hmm. And what was very interesting was that having chaired that competition jury for many years, I got to know a number of legendary singers, including Marilyn Horne, who was on the jury many times, Cheryl Milnes, Carlo Bergonzi, the great tenor who died recently, Galina Wisniewskaya, Gundula Janowitz, Iliana Kotrubash, René Collo, and many others.
Right.
And what was so interesting was hearing their views, mm-hmm, of the young singers that we were listening to together, and realizing that their opinions and their own vocal characteristics were very closely related. Mm-hmm. Joan, mm-hmm, professed not to like giving masterclasses. She did give them in Cardiff, not very frequently elsewhere. And I remember on one occasion, she said to a young singer who may not have had the clearest of diction, "Well, you know, dear, I was always told that I didn't have very good diction, but it didn't seem to do my career any harm."
Interesting, too. And we'll come back to some of the points that you raised there, because they're all of import as well as being fun. Interesting that you emphasized and chose to read the lyrics as well to this, which when you first heard it, presumably you didn't know what this mysterious lady was singing about and
no
where
idea
she was
at all
singing. And very often there are wonderful excerpts or things we've excerpted from opera or even from song recital where the lyrics are really either humdrum or totally crazy or unrelated. But in this case, the words wound up speaking to you as well.
I think singing is all about communicating. Great art is about emotional communication, and I suppose it's that emotional communication that unites all great art, whether it is a novel, whether it's a play, whether it's a piece of chamber music, or indeed whether it is an aria. Some singers have great vocal instruments, but ultimately what reaches me is a total message of emotional communication. When I'm in an opera house listening to a performance, watching a performance, when I'm on a singing competition jury assessing a singer, and I've been lucky enough to be invited on many juries over the years, ultimately, although I do analyze the component parts of a singer's talent and a singer's strengths and weaknesses, if it doesn't add up to something that moves me, then ultimately, in my mind, it doesn't add up to very much.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear an example of that where the human voice, per se, is not involved.
Thank you.
the move into the light of Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata, Opus 53, the 21st Sonata in C major, but in a way that you probably don't know or haven't heard unless you know this recording from 1972 by the great Emil Gilels. Antony Freud, there's a delicacy that we don't always find or associate with some of the more Sturm und Drang Beethoven here.
Gilels was a really complete pianist, so far as I was concerned, and I think the evidence of that is in that movement. It starts with the softest, most lyrical, most vocal delivery of the opening melody, and it becomes titanic. Mm-hmm. There was just nothing he couldn't do. His technique was so staggeringly great that he was able to deliver everything that his extraordinarily acute interpretative brain wanted. He was a phenomenal pianist and is not a household word,
right.
A household name these days, though I think he deserves to be. And he was one of the artists that made such an impression on me as I was growing up in London in the 70s. For a child who got a total addiction on music, on the arts in general, theater, opera, ballet, concerts. London in the 70s was a kind of golden era because...
Just a constant banquet.
Well, I used to go several times a week, whether it was to see Olivier or Gielgud or Richardson at the National Theater, whether it was to hear Richter or Rubinstein or Gilels at the Festival Hall, or whether it was to hear Sutherland, the young Domingo, Vickers, or innumerable other great artists at Covent Garden.
I can see the anger bubbling up in the heads of our listeners now, saying, why didn't we have that childhood adulthood?
It's extraordinary when you think about it,
yes.
How the coincidence of your birth generates opportunities and ambitions, mm-hmm. that I assume would have been completely different in me if my circumstances were different.
Absolutely.
If you'd asked me when I was 14 what I wanted to do when I grew up, honestly, I would have said I want to run an opera company, mm-hmm. because that was already my passion. And I know that sounds totally hokey, but in my case, it's true. And I realize how privileged I am to be one of the fortunate few who can honestly say that I'm able to earn my living by pursuing my passion.
Right. Tell us a bit about how you went to all of these things. Kids tickets, student tickets, cheap seats, standing room? You must have become known to box office people, because though there were probably a few other people your age, most people were older who were showing up regularly at these places.
I suppose that's right, though I'm not sure I was aware of how odd a child I was.
Okay.
For me, it was completely natural. Yeah. I did it because I was passionate about it,
not because
I wanted to give a good impression to anybody.
Right.
And in your list of options,
yes,
all of those.
Okay.
It was, I think, 50 pence to stand at the mm-hmm. back of the Old Vic before the National Theatre moved to its present building on the South Bank. I joined the Young Friends of Covent Garden, and when you were a member of the Young Friends, you got ticket vouchers, the face value of which was the same price or the same value as the price of the cheapest seats in the upper slips.
Uh-huh.
So although I was from a family of very modest means, and although my parents had a appreciation of the arts, they by no means had a enthusiasm for it that matched mine, they nonetheless encouraged mm-hmm. my passion and my growing addiction, and I think were very happy to see me get such excitement and pleasure out of it.
Did you meet other folks in the gods, in the standing areas? Or
I did, yeah. and it's interesting, occasionally I bump into some of them now. Mm-hmm. There is a British agent called Robert Gilder who sent me an email the other day from the Stadshouburg, which is mm-hmm. the old opera house in Amsterdam. And I can't even tell you which year it was. It was probably in the very early 80s. I persuaded my then boss at Sadler's Wells Theatre to drive from London to Amsterdam because Sutherland was singing Lucia in
this
the Stadthalle.
This would have involved a ferry at the time.
Oh, yes. No,
Right. No, I just want to make it clear to those people who think that you drove over the water.
Oh, no, no. It was a long ferry journey, too. It was Harwich to Hook of Holland, I think, which was overnight. This guy, Robert, who as I say, is a British agent, he manages singers, happened to be in the Staatsschauburg that day, that Sunday afternoon. And although we'd nodded at each other across the upper slips at Covent Garden for a couple of years, we'd never actually spoken. And he was back in Amsterdam. I think it must have been, 34 years before he sent me this email a few days ago saying, here I am back in the Staatsschauburg. Do you remember the first time we actually made verbal contact?
Yeah.
It was very interesting to be reminded of that encounter.
There's a special quality to the people with that passion and the ones who, for various reasons, don't have the means to get the fancy seats. And there's a camaraderie that can develop in those settings. I was very touched the other day to see someone had posted online a sort of review of the funeral mass for Licia Albanese, who died at 105 just recently in New York, and went through various artists, various managers. But the main point this writer wanted to make was that a lady who had been a fixture in the Met standing room line since the old Met downtown in New York and had not been seen in some time at the Met was there with an assistant. She was now in a wheelchair and had lost much of her sight. And he said that when she arrived, the church just sort of lit up because this was, as I once saw a photo autographed up in the Nice Opera in the bar for the highest standing area from Gilly, aux vrais amis de l'opéra, les enfants du paradis, the true lovers of opera, the true friends are the children of paradise,
yes.
Children of these upper seats. Your parents were not born in London.
My parents were both Hungarian, from different parts of Hungary. My father was born in a little village called Bicska, which is not far from Budapest.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was born in Győr, which is an industrial city about halfway between Vienna and Budapest.
Right.
And they had the classic Middle European Jewish experience of the first half of the 20th century. My father escaped from Hungary as a refugee in 1939, managed to get a visa to bring him to Scotland, as it happens, on the pretext of his having been a silver fox expert when he'd never seen a silver fox in his life. And he spent the first part of World War II working on a silver fox farm for this Scottish Jewish family that had invited him to come to Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was not so fortunate. When the anti-Semitic laws in Hungary tightened, and when the Nazis finally occupied Hungary, which was very late in the war, they
right.
didn't need to, frankly, because Hungary was doing their job for them just fine.
Right.
She was put into the ghetto in Győr and deported to Auschwitz. She was taken on the march of death into Germany when the Soviet army moved forwards from the east. She was liberated by the American army in Germany, worked for a while for the British Control Commission in Germany, and finally made it to London as a refugee in 1947. Mm. She was a teacher. She was a French and German teacher. And in order to earn a little bit of extra money, apart from her job as a teacher in a school in Hackney in the East End of London, she advertised in the Hungarian press to take some Hungarian students to teach them English.
And a gentleman saw this advertisement, as I recall.
Well, yes. My father saw this advertisement, by which time his mother, who had spent the war in hiding in Hungary, had joined him in the UK, spoke not one word of English, and he thought, well, maybe it would be a good idea for his mother to take some English lessons. His mother actually never learned English, but gained a daughter-in-law.
Yes.
And then my parents married in 1953, and I arrived in 1957.
They had, as you indicate with a careful but broad description of a classic Middle European Jewish upbringing. They had an exposure to culture, I would imagine. They were before the end of the 30s and the beginning of the 40s.
It's a very interesting question, Andrew. You know, I don't know the answer to that. I never asked them that. Mm-hmm. I don't know to what extent they had an exposure to mm-hmm. culture. Both were very well educated. Mm-hmm. My mother, as I say, was a linguist.
What did your father wind up doing after Silver Fox?
He wound up being a manager for Rio Tinto Zinc, the uh-huh. big mining company. His dream was to become a vet. And he wanted to study chemistry in Hungary, but because of the anti-Semitic numerus clausus, he mm-hmm. couldn't get into a Hungarian university to study chemistry. And so he ended up working in a bank in Budapest before he escaped out of the country. So I wonder, it's an interesting question.
That triggers something that might sound off point, but I think it is on point. The first vet that our family had for our first dog was a Hungarian refugee. And he was a very complex man, as many people who had to leave in 56 would have been. And he had been, we later put the pieces together, he was also a survivor from before. And one day he looked at me, and it was clear that he was angry, not at anything I had done as a little boy, but at the people who had just been in there. And he said, "Do you know, in Hungary, a veterinarian is treated as the doctor that he is." And
that's
so
great.
It's interesting that this ambition issue and the science part of it, Kostecki
yes.
was his name, and he always wanted to emphasize that he knew the sciences
yes.
that led to this. So that's an interesting point.
Certainly in London, my parents enjoyed the arts. The reason I started going to the Covent Garden was really through my father's work. Rio Tinto Zinc had some tickets at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden. They were meant for the directors of the company and their guests. But when the directors didn't need them, they were circulated around the staff. And every couple of years, my father had access to a pair of excellent seats on the main floor at Covent Garden. Mm-hmm. And my parents were the sort of people who didn't find a babysitter for me and go to the opera together.
Right.
One of them stayed home and the other one took me.
Right.
And it was in those circumstances.
Parents, listen.
Right. It was in those circumstances that I saw Tito Gobbi singing Scarpia, that I saw Fontaine and Nureyev dancing Romeo and Juliet. And that's where my appetite was whetted.
Right. We're speaking with Anthony Freud, General Director of Lyric Opera of Chicago. And that's a big thing to be, but he's, as you can hear, much more than that. It's rare to see today someone who's unashamed to be a true cosmopolitan and to have a heightened aesthetic, yet also fully plugged in to the reality of the world around him. And that's certainly Anthony Freud. The program is Critical Thinking, 98.7 WFMT or WFMT.com if you're not in Chicago, or even if you are. And I'm your host and producer, Andrew Pattner. WFMT.com/critical thinking is where you can find this or any of our other programs. We've heard from opera. We've heard from the recital hall or the studio of recital material. But let's hear something by and from the English-speaking world. Where's my home?
steady, hey, you are nearly home. The first one died, just died. The other slipped and died, and the third accidental circumstances. What will drink his sorrows, my sorrows dry? And the tide will turn. Fishing, and young Joe has gone fishing, and you'll know who's gone fishing when you land the next shore.
From a modern classic recording of a modern classic opera, John Vickers, along with chorus and orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, Colin Davis presiding in the 1978 Phillips recording of The Miraculous. And still, however many times you've seen it, and our listeners, fortunately, did get to, many of them, see and hear this with John Vickers at Lyric Opera. Peter Grimes of Benjamin Britten. Tell us about you and this piece, or you and this selection, Antony Freud.
This was really the first time when I realized that opera could be truly life-changing. Vickers was one of the great, great artists who I was able to hear many times through my years of going very regularly to Covent Garden. I heard him in many of his great roles, Tristan, Otello, Lazza in Yennefer, Don José. But I suppose of all of them, it was as Peter Grimes that I was most moved, impressed, and transformed by. There was a famous new production of Peter Grimes at Covent Garden. I think it was in 1975 with Vickers, with Colin Davis conducting, directed by Elijah Mashinsky, with Heather Harper, for example, as Ellen Orford. And I saw that, and as with most things at Covent Garden, I didn't see it once. I saw it maybe 8 or 10 times.
I think that's the production that led to this
exactly
this recording.
That, with more or less the same cast.
Right.
And it, in those years, the Royal Opera House regularly took part in the BBC Promenade concerts at the Albert Hall. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's an enormous summer festival organized by the BBC of remarkable music.
We're very glad that at WFMT this year we've returned to what had been a long-standing practice here of sharing the proms, many of them, with our listeners. And
that's
so
great.
That we hope will continue and continue to grow. So we'll add your endorsement.
Absolutely. I endorse it wholeheartedly. Well, as a student, I used to stand in line for many hours in order to get a good place in the arena. The seats are all removed from the main floor of the Royal Albert Hall, and people stand in line for the day in order to get a place in the arena where they stand and listen to the concert.
It's the original mosh pit, but without the body surfing.
Exactly. Yeah. So because I'd already seen this performance of Peter Grimes many times at Covent Garden and loved it, I was determined to get a very, very good place in the arena. And when the doors opened, I suppose it must have been 45 minutes before the concert started, I ran, and I do mean ran, down the stairs ahead of more or less everybody else in the line. I'd been there for just about the whole day and got a place right on the rail, right in the front. Mm. And as it happens, I was not just on the rail, but I was right in front of John Vickers. And when the scene we just heard took place, he was no more than about 4 feet directly in front of me.
Wow.
It was a concert performance. It wasn't semi-staged, but it couldn't have been more vivid in its impact. I also remember that more or less every cast member on stage, and they were sitting in a long line right at the front of the concert platform, were crying while Vickers was doing what is known as his mad scene in Peter Grimes. And at that moment, I realized that opera as an art form truly could change lives. Mm-hmm. And it was a very important, very powerful moment of revelation to me that I still get tingles down my spine thinking about.
What an opportunity, because even if you know Vickers only from audio recording, although fortunately there are many video and film records as well, you know the total possession that a character took of him and that he took of a character, particularly this one.
He had an almost Old Testament elemental prophet-like quality to him. He was larger than the music or the roles he sang.
And as with someone we discussed earlier, Joan Sutherland, later Dame Joan Sutherland, John Vickers had very strong opinions about many things, many controversial opinions, and sort of at a certain point kind of removed himself from a lot of the regular world. But did you ever sit on a jury or interact with John Vickers?
The only time I interacted with him was at the stage door waiting for him to emerge to ask for his autograph.
At that same performance or a different one?
At most of the performances attended at Covent Garden, I'm afraid I was a real stage door Johnny in my teenage years, and I have a large collection of autographs and
you've
signed
kept a hold
photographs.
Of them. Yeah,
I have all my collection. Yes, I stopped doing that a few years ago.
Anthony Freud is lighting up as he tells this, and I should say, having been in the homes of a number of conductors, major conductors, they like to have autographs too, and not just their own. So I don't think you need to be ashamed at all of your early obsession and gathering. The other thing that comes to mind, and as we're about to hear something very different but very connected to what we've just heard, music, dance, theater, yes, for some parts of music, it's very helpful to have some support for an instrument. But for singing, for dance, there's a tremendous democracy in terms of who can get in and then how merit and stick-to-itiveness can move them up. And that democracy is and always has been global. It's increasingly apparent now how global it is. But think about who we've been talking about. Joan Sutherland. She was from
Australia.
Australia. Mm-hmm. John Vickers.
From Canada.
From Newfoundland, right? From Canada. and Emil Gilels from the former Soviet Union. These were not people singing their national anthem or their local song. These were people who were propelled by talent to go on and on. I'm always amazed when you go to the ballet and you look at the names, and then there's always their geographical origin, and it's Kansas and Oklahoma, and there's something very, very special about, and when people raise this, quote, elitist concept, it's such a misunderstanding. We're going to hear from an early recording, early in the sense that the work was not as canonical as it has become. We're going to hear from Winterreise with a singer who may not be familiar to many people.
A singer called Harry Plunkett Green, and this was recorded when he was nearly 70. Mm. It's a favorite recording of mine. It's sung in English. It's the song Der Leiermann, which is the last song in Winterreise. Mm-hmm. It means the hurdy-gurdy man. It's a musical and poetic portrait of utter desolation. In my mind, the scenario of the song reminds me very strongly of Macbeth's great speech in Act 5 of the Shakespeare play, in which he says, "Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." That's the desolation of the hurdy-gurdy man. And Plunkett Green conveys it with a subtlety and a vividness that somehow is enhanced by the frailty of his sound. Mm-hmm. We've heard great voices. We've heard Sutherland. We've heard Vickers. Plunkett Green, at least at this age, did not have a great voice. Mm-hmm. But his ability to animate and energize the text, albeit in a very archaic English translation of the poem, I think has something extraordinary about it.
And hence to communicate, which has been a key to your personal connection to music and what you seek to present as an intendant
Absolutely
of an
right.
opera house. When, where, and how did you encounter this recording?
EMI brought out a very large box of LPs of historic Schubert Lieder recordings, which I bought as LPs. And it's a wonderful set. It has an enormous panorama of great singers from many decades. Of all the, I suppose it must be 8 or 9 LPs, which has translated into probably 5 or 6 CDs when it was reissued on CDs, of all the hundreds of tracks, this is the one that grabbed me most strongly.
Yonder stands a poor old hurdy-gurdy man, and with frozen fingers plays as best he can. Barefoot shuffling sidelong on the icy way, not a single penny in his empty tray, not a single penny in his empty tray. No one seems to heed him, no one stops to hear. Only snarling mongrels care to venture near. Little does he trouble, come whatever may. Still his hurdy-gurdy drones and drones away. Still his hurdy-gurdy drones and drones away. Wonderful old fellow, shall I with you go? Will you drone your music to my songs of woe?
The Hurdy-Gurdy Man, translated into English from Der Leiermann from Winterreise of Franz Schubert, 1934 recording. Irish-based baritone Harry Plunkett Green was then 69 going on 70. In fact, he died in 1936. He was born in 1865. This recording for Columbia at Abbey Road doesn't even have a credit for the pianist, who did a fine job as well, but the sense of discovery that Anthony had when he first heard it, we've now shared in, and I can tell you that not only will we be sharing part two, a second hour of this program and discussion with music with Anthony Freud of Lyric Opera of Chicago, but I'm going to do a Harry Plunkett Green program. I'm going to research this guy. I'm going to find more. I mean, I just, between all the sounds that we've all shared on this station, from John Jacob Niles to Richard Dyer Bennett and others who would appear on the station in general, or Midnight Special or Studs Terkel, I think it's time to put Harry Plunkett Green, 1865 to 1936, into that pantheon. So we're further indebted to Anthony Freud. Anthony, you're going to stick around. We're going to record and then present part two. Thank you so much for sharing these selections from Joan Sutherland on critical thinking today.
It's my great pleasure, Andrew. Thank you so much for having me.
And public thanks to Anthony Freud for joining us today and next week as well. Same time, same station. Thanks to Anthony's executive assistant, Sam Albright, for helping us to arrange the fulfillment of this long-awaited interview. Matt DiStefano put the program together with me and made it sound great. Our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation, and other friends of this program, WFMT.com/critical thinking is where you can find the always free Critical Thinking Podcast, Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, is where you can find me. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.